I'm Angie Carro with another hour of In Deep. How can conservatives possibly see the world the way they do? How can they turn away evidence of evolution? Why do they keep insisting abortions cause breast cancer? It turns out the human brain has all kinds of ways to slough off facts, and the conservative brain is even more immune. Chris Mooney joins us with his new book, The Republican Brain, all this hour on In Deep. Had to let that play out in its entirety because it's so perfect for my next guest, my regular guest. Gotta laugh from the political carnival because you're expecting something profound and wonderful, and you get it, but you also get a little bit of whack. Hey, Buttercup, what's up?
Well, I nearly didn't make it here today. Here I was in the emergency room trying to recover from the shock I experienced after I heard a Republican tell the truth.
Mike, okay, now you're delusional.
No, I swear to God, Joe Scarborough accidentally came
accidentally
out
with, said something real.
Yes. You know, I've never watched that show because it's on so early. But I do see clips occasionally, and I turn them off. They're just not worth it. I'm sorry. But
I was going to say, early's got nothing to do with it. I mean, it could be on demand. I wouldn't be watching it.
He came out with, I'm not sure if you're going to play the clip first or if you would like
me
to.
Yeah, in fact, this is Matt Knows It's True because, okay, you guys, sock it to me. I haven't heard it.
Say this for everybody at home. Yeah. I've yet to meet a single person in the Republican establishment that thinks Mitt Romney's going to win the general election this year. They won't say it.
Oh, and you know, he sounded deliberately honest. He sounded like he was cutting to the chase. Is that what you got?
Well, just from the clip, Mark Halperin was saying something that led into that. Now I can't recall what it is, but I can give you the follow-up. According to the person who posted the YouTube, the follow-up is Mark Halperin disagreed with him, and he did again on TV today. And he said, I don't totally agree with that. Even if you think Romney's going to lose, there's still 2016. If Romney loses, there's so many strong candidates out there. And Scarborough says who? And Halperin says who? Mitch Daniels, Bobby Jindal, Haley Barbour. Oh, not Haley Barbour. Chris Christie, Paul Ryan, Jeb Bush. And Mika comes in and says, are you serious? And Halperin says, there's a bunch of them. And Scarborough says, well, a lot of their times have passed.
You know, what's interesting, though, is he was using that to contradict the statement that Romney's not going to win. And he didn't contradict that at all. He basically said, let's look till next time. You know, let's look.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing.
Oh,
I hope he doesn't win. I'm honestly worried about voter suppression and the hatred of Obama and the money that's pouring in. I mean, I did a piece yesterday that, you know, was talking about super PACs, and it's scary stuff. So if he loses, it will be based on a whole lot of people turning out.
Yep, good to know. We are moving on to someone who, I'm really sorry to hear you're in mourning for Newt Gingrich. What's up?
Yeah, poor old Newton Leroy Gingrich, Inc. his company, which is called Center for Health Transformation, it's a think tank, actually, that raised millions to support his healthcare ideas, went bankrupt. And it's liquidating its assets. And, of course, we know the biggest asset of all is Newt Gingrich. But enough of puns. We're also wondering if Gingrich acted as a lobbyist on behalf of this group. And as a Twitter pal said to me, you can't pay bills with hot air, Newt.
He's finally figuring that out. I love the thought of Gingrich having a think tank that's on empty, though.
Yes. In fact, somebody asked, is this moral bankruptcy? And I think it is. I think that's the whole problem right there. Now, you know, here's Gingrich. If he can't manage his own think tank's finances, how can he manage the country's? What is he even running for? Oh, I forgot. Book sales.
Is that it? You put your finger on it. I kept wondering, why is he still out there? You think that's it? Basically, he's just going to move books?
I think that's what it's boiling down to. And this is also really bad news for Tiffany's. So, you know, he's destroying the economy while he's at it. What are we going to do with this guy?
I don't know. We could turn him over to Mitt Romney.
Oh, yeah. Don't turn any more people over to Mitt Romney. He'll fire them.
True enough. What's up with our good friend Mitt this week?
Well, this week he made it as easy as shooting fish in a Cadillac.
Again?
Oh, well, yes, again. This time he actually came out. You may have the clip on this one.
Matt says. Let's hear this. This is Romney.
Well, Harvard has a terrific program. They call it the joint degree program, where you can apply to the business school and the law school. If you get into both, You can take 5 years of educational training in 4 years. Harvard has a way to make sure, however, you don't get a discount. You pay the full premium for both and the full charge of both. But I was able to do law school and business school in a four-year period. It was a lot of schooling. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, but it was a great opportunity to learn about the law.
Wow, did he need dressing with that word salad? What?
Well, the thing is, here he is, you know, talking on and on about his 4 years at Harvard. And when he was speaking in Pennsylvania, he told an audience that President Obama may have spent too much time at Harvard. And now, Obama spent 3 years there. Romney spent 4 years there. And Willard Romney's sons went to Harvard. So
Be nice. Math is hard.
Well, yeah, if you're a Harvard grad, you should be able to figure this out. You know, projection is his default position. He's doing the thing of taking what he perceives as a weakness and assigning it on to his opponent, although I don't see being a Harvard grad as a negative, but apparently he does. I'm not sure how he does, but he does. So
Because Obama did it. Thus, it is a negative. Thank you for once again enlightening us with your brilliant look at the news. Gotta laugh, it is always a joy.
Yes, I'm the Einstein of the news. That's it.
There you go. Gotta laugh from thepoliticalcarnival.net. As always, pleased to have her on our staff. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Caro, about to talk to Chris Mooney, whose new book out answers so many questions that I know I have had about why you just can't seem to talk facts to some people, as aggravating as that may be. It's something that we need to accept when we're trying to reach across and talk to conservatives, if you're still trying that. The name of the book is The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Don't Believe in Science. And you already know Chris Mooney's name. His book, The Republican War on Science, was a very concise analysis of exactly how the Republican Party tried to attack the very facts of science as we know it, and the allegiances they managed to create in doing so, and how persuasive they were. So it's very good to have him come back with us. And Chris, thank you for joining us for the hour.
It's really great to be back with you again.
I have to tell you, I didn't expect this to have the effect of your basic Hollywood blockbuster. I laughed, I cried, I despaired. You actually do have a very light hand with some very heavy material. The way you started it off, to talk about a gentleman in the time of enlightenment who basically spent his last breathing months exulting at the idea about how ultimately reason would out. Ultimately, we'd all move into this future where people understood that reason, in fact, were the way to a good life. And of course, he went on to immediately die at the hands of his captors. That's a pretty grim way to start this, but it did capture some of the way that I've really been brought up to think, which is that if you just get the facts right, and you can present them to people, eventually they will come around, because this is the way things are. And the science is showing us it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, Angie, I got to thank you. Of all my interviewers, you're the first to give me the opportunity to talk about the Marquis de Condorcet and the French Revolution. So that's pretty awesome. But, you know, I love that story. It's a sad story. We dreamed a dream of reason. The dream of reason was only a dream. And it's too bad it turned out that way, but it makes sense if you think about human beings as the product of evolution. There's no reason that, you know, minds were designed to get at the kind of truth that the scientific process now aspires to. So people have all these commitments, ideological, personal, and what we're starting to understand about the brain is how prior to what we think of as reason, we've already been sent down the garden path of affirming what we want to believe rather than what's true. Everybody does that. And then I go on to talk about how conservatives may do it a little bit differently. But everybody does it. So if we want to be enlightened, the paradox is we have to reject the enlightenment view of reason. Then we're enlightened.
This is turning more Zen by the moment.
Sorry about that.
But it's true. I mean, the rational thing to do is to be a little less married to the rational. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of that, let's talk about the division that you're embracing here, which is the liberal brain and the conservative brain. And I want to rush to reassure everyone, you're not basically saying this is a binary system, there are only two kinds of people in the world, et cetera. I mean, it's more nuanced than that.
No, these are tendencies, you know, but there is a whole middle, and all of the kind of traits blend together differently in different people. I say in the book that I score high on one conservative trait, but I'm a liberal. And so that kind of lets you see how it works. But in aggregate, there are some psychological traits that are clearly political. and they clearly correlate with whether you're on the left or on the right, and it works across countries. So something is definitely going on there.
Well, I would assume that you're referring, as I know you're referring to the fact that you are more meticulous than the average liberal is the one trait that you have that's more conservative. I found it very reassuring that the average liberal's house is as messy as mine is. That's what that comes down to.
Right. You know, liberals are messier. And this is why in conservatives are, you know, like order and structure, including in their apartment and, the you know, but more conventional in their decorations, things like American flags, right, rather than Frank Zappa, you know, naked sitting on the toilet or something. So... You know, the point is that politics is clearly much more than the ideological debates we have if it's showing up in interior design, right? And
yes.
But that's just one of the many, many studies that gets at the non-political differences between liberals and conservatives. They have different art preferences, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You just go down the list. Different senses of humor. They play video games differently. If you show them a collage of pictures, their eyes go to different places first. You know, conservatives look into scary things and liberals are looking at the little happy bunny rabbit. So we got to pay attention to what the science is starting to say about what really divides us.
What I find interesting, a little sidestep here before we get further into the meat of it, and it's you showed us a couple different spectrums along which people exist, and there are right-wing intellectuals, there are left-wing people who are meticulous as to their surroundings. One thing you were not able to find, and that other scientists have not been able to find, is a liberal authoritarian. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, I suspect that there are some, and I suspect that in, you know, a left-wing regime like authoritarian regime, you know, totalitarian regime like the Soviet Union, there were plenty on the left, because then it flips. So an authoritarian is a disposition, a personality type that tends to be associated with the right. And psychologically, what this is associated with is what they call rigidity. And what that means is, you know, having fixed views, viewing the world in terms of very binary systems, good and evil, black and white, right and wrong. You know, if you're not with me, you're against me, my way or the highway. And defaulting to existing structures of authority, and existing structures of hierarchy, and just thinking that that's okay. So we know that the conservative and Republican Party in the U.S. has become more authoritarian. The question is, can you get this personality type on the left? And scientists went hunting for him. I'm sure there are some. It seems to be much less common. But if you flip things so that you have, you know, basically the status quo be the left, in something like, as I mentioned, the Soviet Union, then there's every reason to think that the authoritarians will ratify the status quo then, and that they will be supporters of the regime. So, because it's different in different cultures, and it's culturally, contextually dependent.
I'm talking to Chris Mooney about his new book, The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Don't Believe in Science, and that's out now. You'll find a link on our website to therepublicanbrain.com. Our website is indeepradio.com. Chris, let's talk about how these brain functions that we've been alluding to work. I have a conservative brain. You come to me and you show me this is why I know that not only there is global warming, but that it is in fact caused by humans. What's happening in my brain as I take that information in?
Well, it very much depends on the context in which I show you. If I've known you for a long time, and I come up to you in a personal way, and we have a conversation, and we talk about all the things we have in common and then when I talk about global warming, I talk about it in a way that kind of affirms your values, then it might not lead to a big rejection. But, you know, if it's me on MSNBC arguing with a conservative, then, you know, emotional buttons are being pushed and everybody's taking sides. Mm-hmm. And so in that context, basically, you know, if you're a movement conservative and you're well informed about, you know, conservative views, then the word global warming is probably going to affect you really fast, and maybe even before you know it, with this, you know, whole set of associations. You know, it's emotionally tagged, and it's tagged with things like phony studies, hoax, liberal, you know, liberal hogwash, whatever it is, the things that Rush Limbaugh says. And so then, you know, your mind will quickly pull up all the reasons that you already know to believe that it's a hoax. And usually, in my experience with conservatives, one of the first things they pull up is ClimateGate, mm-hmm. This, you know, three-year-old pseudo scandal, University of East Anglia. This was just pulled up on the air in MSNBC with me by S.E. Cupp. That was the first thing she said. It's the first thing they always say, because that was seared into their minds as the moment that global warming was refuted forever. And that turns out to be wrong, but they've fixed on it.
Now, let me analyze this a bit further. Here's someone who is attacking you on the air. You're the liberal stand-in. You're the liberal guy, capital L. And she is presenting you with what she believes to be her proof that this isn't true. How do we know that her brain is literally comprehending facts differently than yours is? Or how do we know that she bloody well knows the facts? There is political gain to be made by her denying it.
Well, it's really tough because we're talking about an individual, and we've just laid out carefully that, you know, these psychological generalizations work when you study large groups and controlled experiments. But any one person, what are they up to? Well, that's a combination of their psychology, their personal experience, and there might well be people who are completely cynical out there, and we can't really know what is driving any one individual. So, yeah, that's possible.
But we do know that the average person, you know, as the science is supporting, is first going to have that emotional rush of what's going on, and the second thing to kick in is going to be the rational, and the plot of the rational is going to be determined by the emotional. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, most of the time. Yeah, and especially what's so mind-boggling about this is, especially if this is a conservative who's really engaged. You know, in other words, a good mark of engagement would be watching Fox News. So they've heard all the stuff about global warming, and they've learned all the things that they think and conservatives think about global warming. Then is when you're going to get the real bias, right? If it's someone, and there are a lot of people out there that aren't paying attention to politics, and they not even know if they're liberal or conservative because they haven't given enough attention, these things are not going to strike them the same way because they haven't built up all the essentially brain connections that go around the topic. So it's the more educated, more engaged conservative that is really, really hard to convince.
You just brought up something very important there, which we're not talking about relative intelligence. You're not dumber if you think the one way as opposed to the other way.
Now, when I did the research on psychology of ideology, and I went and interviewed all the scholars who do this, all the scientists who do this, you know, the conversation was never about intelligence. It was about psychological traits that vary within a range and that are normal. You know, so they get accused of pathologizing conservatism, but that's not what they're doing. They're saying that, you know, you measure these traits, they vary within a range, and, you know, if you're on this end of the range, then chances are you're conservative. You know, betting odds you'd win in Vegas, you know, that you're conservative. If you're on this end of the range for this trait like openness to new experience, then very good betting odds you're liberal. Doesn't work every time, works a lot of the time. It works more than half the time. Well, more than half the time.
You are a betting man.
Yeah.
But it does bring to mind the argument that you hear when, for example, conservatives claims that universities push a liberal agenda, and then you hear the response, well, if you're educated, you're going to have a more liberal agenda. You're going to have a more liberal view of the world. That ain't necessarily so. You can be intellectual and still have a conservative perspective on the world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that universities do push a liberal perspective because universities are full of liberals, but it's much more than that, than just that. It's not brainwashing.
All right, we're going to talk more with Chris Mooney as we continue through the hour. His book is The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Don't Believe in Science. And later this hour, we'll be talking about how to take all this information into a new approach to conservative conversations. I'm Angie Cuero. This is In Deep.
The lunatic is on the grass. The lunatic is on the grass. Remembering games, daisy chains and laughs. Got to keep the loonies on the path. The lunatic is in the hall. The lunatics are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor. And every day the paper boy brings more. And if the dam breaks open many years too soon, blade. You make the change. You rearrange me till I'm sane. You lock the door. Throw away the key. There's someone in my head, but it's not me.
Welcome back to In Deep. I'm talking to author Chris Mooney about his new book, The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Don't Believe in Science. Chris Mooney is the best-selling author of The Republican War on Science. You'll find his new book out from Wiley. We have a link to that on our page at indeep.com. Chris, we were talking about the political personalities that are out there, and those break down to an acronym that you explain in the book, OCEAN, O-C-E-A-N.
Sure. OCEAN is the acronym for the Big Five personality test. And in the acronym, every letter refers to one of the five traits that are comprise the total human personality. So your O is for openness to new experience. C is for conscientiousness. E is for extroversion, or its opposite, introversion. A is for agreeableness. And then N is for neuroticism, or its opposite, emotional stability. So the first two traits are the ones that are most political. Liberals and conservatives aren't exactly the same on any of them. But the first two, openness to new experience, is all about, you know, not just the willingness, but the desire and drive to try out new things, you know, new vacation spots, new restaurants, whatever it is. But also being comfortable with, you know, abstract thinking, creativity, nuance, uncertainty. These things go into making a liberal a lot of the time, most of the time. Conscientiousness is wanting order and structure in your life, and these things go along with being a conservative most of the time.
It's funny because while you were listing those in the book and I was reading them, it was bringing to mind for me something that subsequently you ended up bringing in the book, and that is George Lakoff's compartmentalization of you know, here's how a liberal looks at the world, here's how a conservative looks at the world. And this, the OCEAN acronym, some of the elements of that put me in mind of Lakoff saying, well, we have this family dynamic in the liberals where they have, you know, the nurturing mother, the calmer, and then here's the conservative dynamic where you have the authoritarian father and the laws are laid down very clearly. You know, you need to be told what is wrong and what is right. So a little bit of that spills into the George Lakoff work.
It does, because the low pole of openness, where you're really not open, is associated with authoritarianism. Okay, and authoritarianism is, we've talked about it already, you know, authoritarianism goes very well with the strict father family, and you will obey the father. And authoritarianism is now today actually measured based upon your views of child rearing. The most modern measurement of authoritarian, other measurements have been, I think, superseded, and now they ask you what is a good trait in a child? And the authoritarians simply answer obedience, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if you're not authoritarian, you answer, oh, well, you know, creativity and things like that. So that's kind of the test right there.
One of the things you're really careful to note in the book throughout, and I was impressed by how much you bent over backwards to do this, a lot of this saying that people aren't open or that people are authoritarian can be perceived as a value judgment. And throughout, you leap to say, no, this is an assessment. This is not a value judgment. I'm not sitting here saying conservatives are bad people and liberals make great parents. You're not saying anything of the sort.
No, I mean, I always try to emphasize that these traits are normal and they are part of humanity and part of human nature, and they show up across countries. You know, they definitely, I mean, in different situations, these traits are going to serve you well or ill. You know, and so if you're not flexible when in a situation where you need to be flexible, that's bad, right? On the other hand, if there's a situation where you need to be inflexible, then it's good. And there are situations like that, including, you know, wartime leadership situations, which is where conservatives often tend to shine. So, you know, situational benefits and costs to this kind of analysis. But liberals thrive in a situation where they have to weigh the evidence and linger in the uncertainty and make sure they get all the nuance right. And that's why most scientists are liberal, and that's why liberals in the scientific community have a natural affinity, and that's why in the present moment liberals tend to be factually right, right? Mm-hmm. Because these issues are complicated. And that's ultimately how I provide a scientific basis for Stephen Colbert's claim that reality has a well-known liberal bias. Well, yes, it's funny. It's also true.
But it also shows something of a scientific underpinning to the cliche of a liberal circular firing squad. We're so busy trying to figure out what's right as a group, and we're all engaging in so much nuance that we don't get anywhere.
Oh, right. Yeah, this is the old Monty Python joke, you know, are you in the People's Front of Judea or the Judean People's Front? And, you know, the two groups want to kill each other. Right? So, you know, I'm going to nuance myself away from that person who agrees with me about 99% of things, and I'm going to stand out and be different and show why over here I should get all the funds. And that's an endemic problem in liberal activism in the environmental community, but in many, many communities.
In fact, I'm going to cheat toward the end of the book with this. I mean, you have a very impassioned plea to liberals toward the end of the book, talking about, you know, you can't wait for the perfect president. You know, you can't. Yes, you love Obama, but he did this wrong, this wrong, this wrong, and this wrong. It might be time to have some actual faith in your president and to have some support for your president.
Right. I kind of put that in because I knew it was going to make some liberal readers barf. But I kind of wanted to do that just to show how alien the thought is. You know, the idea that you just put your faith in a leader and trust them unhesitatingly. But that's, conservatives do that, and look at how well they do when they do that. You know, they backed George W. Bush to the hilt.
You haven't had this conversation yet with Glenn Greenwald, have you?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay, just asking.
Why? What should I expect?
Well, I know that Greenwald takes a great deal of pride, and I admire his work. I'm not slamming him. He takes a great deal of pride in enumerating everything that Barack Obama is doing wrong and saying, you know, what's wrong with you liberals that you can't pay attention to what he's doing to personal freedoms, that he's, you know, continuing the policies of George W. Bush with the extradition and being held without charges, all of which I think are very valid. But, of course, the cliched liberal, you know, parsing through everything that's wrong with the president, and you end up with nobody supporting the president.
Hey, I can give you a rant about what the president did wrong on global warming if you want. I mean, you know, at some point you have to kind of like, it's sort of like, I guess I'm kind of also making the resist the nader temptation kind of argument too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, don't fall for this idea that you got to have a leader who's absolutely perfect, does everything you want. The opposite is way worse. And if, you know, if the conservatives were in your shoes, I can tell you what they would do. And that's why they always win. So, I mean, this is a kind of hard-nosed political pragmatic argument, but I just tie it to liberal psychology. Liberals have this temptation to undermine themselves.
Well, and of course, this is the point of the whole book. I mean, you're not reporting on science as a fascinating little bauble that we're going to look away from. This is all information that we're going to try to use to make political realities a little bit better. And to go back to what we were discussing a few minutes ago, and that is the profile of the authoritarian, the way that the conservative mind takes in information and the sort of personality profile they have, there are three different items on one page in your book where it shows that you really can't divorce the scientific from the political. For example, authoritarians, I'm reading from your book here, are very intolerant of ambiguity, inclined toward groupthink, and distrustful of others, often including racial outsiders. And you know, we're already seeing that with the Trayvon Martin coverage, where the right and the whites tend to think that it's already been overcovered. A little bit further down the same page, you say they're often religiously conservative fundamentalists who believe the Bible is the unedited word of God. And authoritarians penchant to commit what in psychology is called the fundamental attribution error, ignoring situational explanations for someone's behavior, assuming the behavior is reflective of who the person is. A classic example would be blaming a person in poverty for being too lazy to get a job. So it's undeniable that while all of this is interesting science, it has direct bearing on how someone forms their political ideals.
Oh, no, there's just no doubt that the authoritarian is a creature of the political right. For all these reasons. I mean, you know, you might get some confused ones that end up in a left-wing movement, but they're way more comfortable on the right. There's going to be no way to escape the knowledge that's starting to come out of political psychology. And political psychology is now being extended into political physiology, political genetics. You know, this is all research, and of course, you know, actually brain scan studies too. This is all research, and there's just too much of it now for it all to be a wild goose chase. You know, too many different researchers, all coming up with similar sounding things. It's not just a flash in the pan. It isn't going to go away because there would be no way you could get this much evidence if we were all down the wrong path. So the world won't ignore it, not forever. It makes people extremely uncomfortable. But at some point, you have to say, why does... You know, I talk about in the book one of the simple personality studies. A group at Yale took something like 13,000 people, and they just gave them a real simple form of the five-factor personality test, and then they gave them they measured their level of education, level of income, and left right bias, and the signals for personality influencing politics made it appear that. Openness was at least as strong as level of education, maybe stronger than level of education in predicting liberalism. So, we've always said that going to college makes you liberal. Well, having an open personality makes you liberal. Mm-hmm. So these political differences are really rooted deep down in who we are and in human nature.
I want to remind our audience, we're talking to Chris Mooney, author of The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. You might know Chris, too, from his hosting work on Point of Inquiry podcast. He writes the Intersection blog for Science Progress, and you may have seen his writing in Mother Jones, American Prospect, Harper's, Washington Post, USA Today, and Slate, and he's even been on TV with Stephen Colbert. Let's talk about some of those physical differences, Chris, and this is especially centering on the amygdala. I mean, it's hard to say that there aren't physical differences when apparently it's the measurement, am I correct, of the amygdala that may contribute to your political personality?
Right. I mean, now we're getting into the most cutting-edge stuff. So there's a couple studies now, and the most recent one was in the U.K., where they just look at they scan the brains of liberals and conservatives. And what is happening is that conservatism is being associated a couple times now with the amygdala. And the amygdala is part of what's called the limbic system, the emotional brain. And it's a part of the brain that we share with all other animals, And it does the same thing in us that it does in other animals. And that is that it rapidly... controls your response to fear and threat, and it conditions your life-saving response, fight or flight. The amygdala takes over when you need to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. So it takes over, and your rational capacities are irrelevant in that situation. Think about if you're just about to get on the elevator. This happened to me, and my building has dogs, right? Mm-hmm. And so the door opens, and a dog jumps out at me. Because someone doesn't have it on tight enough of a leash.
Yikes.
And that just happened recently. My amygdala takes over, basically, right? And I jump back and, all this stuff. And eventually you calm down a couple seconds later and the dog's been yanked back and you're not, fighting with the dog. But that's what it does. All right, so to find that this appears to be politically correlated is very striking. And, I mean, this is new research, but... It dovetails with a lot of the psychology things, which is why they went looking at this.
Mm-hmm.
So fear of threat. I mean, 9/11 was an amygdala moment, and we saw a conservative shift in the populace, and I shifted conservative. I remember, I became more supportive of George W. Bush, and I became I was living in Washington D.C. and I became terrified. I mean, the whole country was traumatized. And that kind of trauma had a political implication.
Well, let's talk about different reactions to that, because I won't say immediate. I mean, your immediate reaction on seeing a building of that stature blow up is, obviously going to be mostly gut reaction. But almost as soon as the rational reaction started clicking in, my fear was that the country would go conservative. I mean, that kicked in almost immediately. What does that tell us about your brain process versus my brain processes?
Well, it's a good instinct to have that the country's going to go conservative, because this kind of thing definitely pushes people conservative. I mean, you had different knowledge base than me, and I think you were probably right and I wasn't. But nevertheless, that was how it felt to me.
But in terms of the brain science, does that tell you anything about how our brains operate differently, the fact that we came to those two different rational thoughts?
No, I mean, maybe I have a more active amygdala, but also maybe I didn't have the same experience as you. So, I mean, I think it's hard to really, really say too much. But I just know that a lot of people reacted like me. There were liberal hawks, you remember, who wanted to fight Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
And I was one of them. I regret this. I have apologized. But, you know.
Well, I'm also, I'm at the risk of treating you like a tea leaf reader, too. Yeah. Okay, now tell me what my brain's doing, Chris.
Well, we have to be real careful with individuals. You know, people want me to say, you know, what's up with Romney? What's up with Santorum? And I mean, Santorum really fits the conservative profile nicely, and Romney doesn't fit it as nicely. And conservatives have the suspicion of Romney, so it's like they can feel it on him. But I haven't given a personality test to these guys. So, you know, I mean, I think you have to be a little cautious with any one particular person.
But in the effort to understand people to whom a Romney would appeal or someone to whom a Santorum would appeal, let's talk about motivated reasoning. Tell me what that is.
Motivated reasoning is something that we all do. And basically what this is it's a way of defending your beliefs and your identity and the group you belong to. And it's an emotional process in which, you know, you perceive some threat to your belief system. I mean, let's just take a Christian conservative and let's say, you know, the topic is evolution and it's a new study coming out proving, you know, a missing link or something like that. And so you've been conditioned to associate with a group that rejects evolution, rejects it, you know, on moral grounds. It depraves humanity. It leads to all this sin. You know, kids having sex and getting pregnant at 14. This is your thought process. So you hear about evolution. And so it strikes you emotionally first because you see it as a threat. And then your mind retrieves all of the reasons that you don't trust evolution, all of the reasons you've heard in your church, all the reasons you've heard from your pastor, all the reasons you've heard from maybe, you know, the newsletter you read. So by the time you're conscious of rejecting this argument, you know, all of these things have happened. And then you're about ready at that point to make an argument. You know, that's about when you start to get, and then people have different levels of sophistication. Mm-hmm. People have different levels of knowledge, and the ones who are really sophisticated go and write blogs in which, you know, they go and they give you all the reasons why, you know, intelligent design is right. And, you know, and scientists are biased and they're suppressing the few scientists who are brave enough to stand up for intelligent design. And, you know, universities don't practice academic freedom. And then you can just imagine how it goes, right?
I remember the phrase you used in the book, which I found very useful, smart idiots.
Yeah. And people get mad at me about this one. But, I mean, I think it captures something. It captures that the problem is not intelligence. That in fact, you know, let me rephrase that. I mean, it captures that conservatives are not dumb. Mm-hmm. But when they're intelligent and they have strong beliefs, they're actually more likely to double down on wrong claims and to come up with all kinds of reasons to justify them. And this is a motivated reasoning kind of process. If you are emotional in your reasoning, and we all are, but if you have a really fixed, dogged beliefs and you're sophisticated, then you can come up with all kind of reasons and never budge.
We've got another segment to go with Chris Mooney as we discuss his book, The Republican Brain. And believe it or not, we're going to move into the realm of one of his own experiments and Lady Gaga. We're going to tie that all together as we continue here with Chris Mooney on In Deep Radio. You can find us on Facebook, by the way, In Deep with Angie Coro, and we tweet at In Deep Radio.
Stop. We'll be right back.
You're listening to In Deep. I'm Angie Coyer. My guest is Chris Mooney. He's the host of Point of Inquiry. That's a podcast. We'll find a link to that on our blog at indeep.com. And he's relevant to this media conversation, the author of The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science. So, Chris, you were inspired enough, a combination of both your own research and the fact that you met an intriguing fellow who seemed ripe to do this with. You started to set up your own experiments. And part of what you were doing was looking to see whether other areas of interest, be it sports, be it popular music, whatever, would incite the same kind of brain action and emotional reaction as issues political did.
Right. So a lot of, you know, very early on in the process of researching this book, I interviewed the mentors of a recent PhD named Everett Young, who had done all of his research on liberals and conservatives and their psychological differences. And I read his whole dissertation. And, you know, it just showed you how much depth of research there is in this area. And then also he was pushing it further. And so I said to him, well, you know, I get the sense that conservatives are doing a lot of motivated reasoning about scientific issues. And he said he'd never thought about it before. And eventually we just talked and talked and talked, and we set up a study. And what we wanted to do was to see if liberals and conservatives reasoned in a motivated way differently, or, you know, whether one did it more. One group did it more. And it wouldn't be sufficient to just ask them political questions or, you know, assault their beliefs on political issues and then see how much they try to defend their beliefs. Because, you know, you could always say, well, you know, they just have a different investment in that topic on the left than on the right. So we threw in a bunch of non-political topics, like, you know, whether, you know, your favorite singer, whether your favorite singer was actually, you know, using auto-tune in the studio and couldn't actually sing. You know, it was always about attacking something you believed in. And so whether your favorite football team, whether Drew Brees is actually a terrible quarterback, you know, I mean, whatever it was, and the program would randomly assign people essays that either agreed with them or disagreed with their previously expressed opinions on sports, on music. But then also we put in our two political topics. And one was climate change and one was nuclear power, because the right's supposed to be more biased on climate and the left is supposed to be more biased on nuclear power. So that was our experiment. Shall I tell you the result?
I'm still back on the Lady Gaga, and it's an opportunity for me to remind people that this is not a dry book, because the way that you went after Lady Gaga alone by constructing this dialogue of how she's, boy, she can't hit a tune. She only knows two chords. It was great fun. So, yes,
well,
please.
We made up all kinds of awful lies about all kinds of people, right? And for the purpose of the study. I mean, that was because we needed it to be not true, but we needed it to sound plausible. And Everett is actually a musician, and he's done a lot of studio recording. So he was able to make up a great fake essay about studio engineers just griping about how terrible this musician is and how they have to fix their tuning. And, you know, so that was funny. We wrote it like a sort of like pseudo expose, like Rolling Stone style. And we did a bunch of them like this. We did a pseudo sports writer, you know, talking about phony statistics that prove that Drew Brees is like a terrible quarterback.
And what did you yield from all this?
Well, it didn't, you know, we confirmed some things and we didn't confirm some things. This is what's great about science, you know, and we now, if we get a chance, you know, there's a new experiment to do. So it was really interesting that we didn't see a difference between left and right on non-political issues, and we're not really sure why. But something about the political ones did match largely the hypothesis. And the most amazing thing was that the conservatives were more biased than the liberals on nuclear power, which we didn't expect, right? You know, because you get all this stuff about liberals and liberals, you know, if there's anything they deny science on is they don't like nuclear power. Well, we found that, you know, the liberals and conservatives started out from actually not all that different positions on nuclear power. There's a lot of overlap in terms of being pro or con. But then once you attacked their beliefs, whatever their initial view was, once you attacked it, and then you asked them how convincing the, you know, essay that attacks your beliefs is and how much your beliefs had changed, we really found the conservatives doubling down on their beliefs more. And then on global warming, what we found was that in association with level of political knowledge, conservatives were doubling down a lot.
You also found out that the conservatives spent less time taking information in, spent less time taking
in. This is the biggest surprise and the strongest finding. And this is the and this fits a lot of research that we didn't bring in, and now this is the direction that we should go, is that whatever it was doing was he measured the time that people spent reading the essays on the computer screen, you know, in milliseconds. And this is just something you can do with the program we were running. And so it turned out that liberal or conservative, you know, whether or you were reading an essay that agreed with you or disagreed with you, whether it was on a political topic or not, the conservatives were just flying by, not taking any time. And the liberals were spending a lot more time reading. And that correlated with openness to new experience. And it gets to an aspect of conservatism that is in other studies, which is that conservatism is kind of quick economical thinking, and liberalism is all about making things complicated. And we think that we detected a little bit of that, but this has never been found before that we know of, this big difference in reading time. Mm-hmm. We think it's important. We think it points to new research. But this is one study, and that's how science works.
Well, and of course, science is at its best when it actually gives us usable takeaway. So let's talk about the takeaway of all this work that you've done and all of the work that you've summarized. You have conservatives and liberals, and according to their political profile, to some extent their physical attributes, we talked about the amygdala, the way that we employ motivated reasoning, and you did note that for some conservatives, they deal in more or more intense motivated reasoning. You've really well established that we have two different ways of perceiving the world and taking in information. Let's talk about what that tells us as progressives trying to either make persuasive arguments or win elections, whichever way. What's the usability in this? Because if I can add as an aside, part of it was very hard for me to take in because there's some fact-resistant part of me that is stamping her feet up and down going, but for God's sake, it's facts. Why do I have to accommodate people who can't take in facts? And of course, your whole point is you can't change that.
No, yeah. I mean, if you argue facts when someone's really emotional and has a deep-seated belief, then you're hitting a brick wall. So I think that the biggest implication of this for progressives is, you know, it opens your mind to the fact that there is a whole mass of humanity that does not see the world the way you do. So it's kind of like step out of your worldview and just realize that the quick assumptions that you make may be exactly the wrong thing for the instincts you have about how to communicate may be exactly wrong for as soon as you get outside of your audience. Or the things that make you emotional may push the exact opposite button. And so I think that that's really, really surprising, but it points towards, you know, better approaches towards dealing with the middle in particular. Because I think conservatives are going to be very hard to move most of the time. And not just because of their traits, but because of the media channels that they're in. I mean, if Fox News is reinforcing what they believe, and you're trying to change them, Fox News is going to win. Mm-hmm. So, but there is this middle. There are all these people that they've got part conservative aspects to them. They've got part liberal aspects to them. They can move. But the kinds of conservative thinking and arguments and styles. I'm not saying substance, because I don't think liberals should change their substance. That may really open a door there. Like, so, and if you don't, if you're not aware of that, then the door is shut for you to influence people in all the ways that you might be able to. So I think it really makes a big deal for trying to reach the middle and the undecideds.
Let's talk about using this kind of information to target exactly what we're doing. For example, maybe it doesn't make sense to make persuasive commercials during an election because people essentially already have their mind made up. Maybe what the best use of a political commercial would be to remind them to go to the polls. I mean, it sounds as though some of the science here suggests that you're not about to change people's mind, and spending X amount on a TV buy is not going to get people to change their political ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to do the research there. And I think that, you know, political advertising is a tricky thing. But this research does shed a lot of light on that as well. Pressing the fear button right before an election in an ad campaign is such a political thing to do, you know, and, really, really fast flashing images that excite emotions. I mean, all the research is going to show that this is going to have a huge effect It's frankly, you know, manipulative because we're perceiving these things. We don't even know how they're influencing us. So this research is going to change our thinking about political advertising, too. I mean, I think it definitely is.
Chris Mooney is the author of The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. I have heard people suggest in intense political conversations that the Republicans / conservatives may actually be more organized and methodical about using new information, even information that comes from a confessed progressive or liberal, and putting that science into work faster to actually make it, for example, in taking Lakoff's work and making it work for the Republicans instead of the Democrats. How do you think the Republicans or the conservatives could look at your book and say, I'm going to put that to use for us?
They could. I mean, they really could, because they would know more about what liberal weaknesses are, and they would know more about conservative strengths. You know, that's not what they do. You know, in the book, I talk about how they always attack the research and claim that it's calling them crazy, even though it isn't. And I don't think that they need to do that, but that is their most natural reaction. So what can you say? I mean,
are you seeing that already?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the number of people who have criticized my book and actually read it is very small. The number of people who have criticized my book without reading it, you know, having a defensive reaction, is very large. And, of course, they are confirming the argument. But that's mostly what's happening. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the fact that you, again, go out of your way to be even-handed. I saw some of the most original discussion of the issue of fracking in the book. And I confess to being a knee-jerk environmentalist, I have to stop and say, now, wait a minute, you don't know enough about this. And fracking is one of those things I haven't read up enough on. So let's talk about what you were discussing there with the way the liberals look at an issue like fracking and maybe assume it is immediately, you know, polluting, or it's immediately something to fight against.
Yeah, well, this is one where, I mean, I've diverged from the left. And you know, when you think about it, it's the perfect test case issue because it's clearly the kind of thing that liberals are going to get emotional about, because you've got industry, okay? So you've got power, and we're egalitarian. And then you've got claims of harm, and we worry about protecting the innocent and the weak and all the rest. These are our emotional values. So it's the perfect, you know, it's exactly the kind of thing that if you wanted to trap us, you could trap us on this. And but what is the claim borne out? And my assertion is not that they've never, ever polluted any drinking water. But my assertion is that it doesn't seem like fracking is the problem most of the time. And fracking itself refers to a process that happens, you know, sometimes as much as a mile beneath the surface. And water doesn't run uphill. So, you know, it's very hard for something happening down there to get up into your drinking water. What that means is when they're messing up, which they sometimes are, it's happening at the surface. The only reason this matters is that the campaign's against fracking, which is not at the surface. You know, so, you know, the answer for me is it's probably a regulatory issue, and it doesn't mean you should ban something that doesn't seem to be the real cause. And that's the argument that I make. I think that argument has been missed for a lot of environmental organizations working on this issue. But the science is, you know, again, if you're a mile below the surface, okay, and the water's being pumped down and vertical, it doesn't, you know, sorry, excuse me, I misspoke. Being pumped down and then being pumped horizontal, mm-hmm. It doesn't go vertical a mile unless, you know, there is some extraordinary circumstance because it has to travel under pressure to go vertical. So anyway, you know, I mean, it's a physics issue.
But keeping this in the context of the studying that you did, what's going on in the liberal brain when they get confronted with these facts about fracking? When they hear something, we've already talked about, you know, the fact that as liberals, you know, we do tend to value education. We do tend to value rationality. So I hear someone say, look, this is not going to percolate up a mile. Even as a liberal, I'm thinking, well, that kind of makes sense. What does your study of brain chemistry tell you might be happening in the minds of liberals when they're confronted with these facts?
Well, when they're confronted with what I said, I don't know. But, I mean, when they hear about fracking, they generally hear about it in a way that pushes two liberal emotional buttons, which is, you know, Dick Cheney, Halliburton got some kind of exemption. And, you know, that just pushes so many of our buttons because we are egalitarians, you know, and we fear concentrated special interests having power. And, you know, we are communitarians and we fear, you know, systems that, you know, take advantage of the weak and cause harm unfairly, and that don't protect citizens. So, you know, we get our emotions going from the way that the fracking issue is framed. And from there, you know, it's not going to be enough of us, I think, that step back most of the time, unless, but the good news is that we like science. You know, we have an emotional connection to that too. So when I give you some physics and I say it's going to be very hard to get water to travel uphill, I'm not saying it's impossible, it's going to be very hard, you need pressure, then I think I do make some people stop and pause. And that's a talking point that a scientist studying this actually gave me. And I'm now stealing it. So,
well, let me take you back for our last question. I want to take you back to the beginning of the book, and you drew a distinction between persuading people about something that's a simple fact, what date Mother's Day is on, and that's a whole different issue than trying to talk about who caused global warming and what's going to happen with global warming. You made the distinction between those two different kinds of facts. So, can you extrapolate for me what the areas are that we are arguing about in this election year where facts can still help us? When it comes down to numbers, when we say X amount of people are now employed or X amount of the debt has been retired or that sort of thing, is there still room, is there still a reasonable use for numbers and facts on some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, put really well, a choice statistic can be an incredibly powerful soundbite. You know, I mean, it's just that motivated reasoners are not at all above using numbers and twisting statistics, lies, damn lies, and statistics to support what they think. And in fact, the most sophisticated motivated reasoners will be able to do that. So you have to be aware of that. But I mean, still, if you want to get a message across, then I think that the facts and figures will be helpful if they're the choice figures. But, you know, if liberals data dump and give lots of statistics and bowl people over, you know, then that's not going to work at all. I mean, the 99% and the 1 is just a powerful statistic, you know, and I mean, it's a soundbite more than a statistic. So that kind of thing, absolutely.
And never will the soundbite die. We're always going to have that. Chris Mooney, thanks for making so much time for us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chris Mooney is the best-selling author of the New York Times bestseller, Republican War on Science, and he's now out with The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. And that's a wrap on In Deep. Find out more about the show, including how to support us, at indeepradio.com. We're on Facebook as In Deep with Angie Coiro. Follow us on Twitter at In Deep Radio. Our executive producer is Gordon Whiting. Engineers Matt Fiddler. Office queen is Jill of All Trades. Interns are Kristen Stevens and Forrest, this guy, Phillips. I'm Angie Coiro. Thanks for tuning in. We will see you next week on In Deep. Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep with Angie Coiro, a production of Talkback Studios. You can get more information about us at indeepradio.com. And while you're there, you can become a member and support our work. There's a link there to contact us, too, with any questions or feedback. We're developing a series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and we'd love to have you be part of that. Please send us your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions through our website. Click the contact button at indeepradio.com. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Coiro. We'll see you then. You're listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.